Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a playwright, a novelist and a translator. After 2 years national service, during which he learned Russian, he read philosophy at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. He then worked as a reporter and a columnist for The Guardian and The Observer. He's written 11 novels, I think, including Towards the End of the Morning, and 17 plays, ranging from Noises Off, recently chosen as one of the nation's three favourite plays ever, to Copenhagen, which won the 1998 Evening Standard Award for Best Play of the Year and the 2000 Tony Award for Best Play. He's been longlisted, shortlisted, or won many literary awards. He's also, as we find out, huge in Harare. Michael Frayn, welcome to Meet the Writers. I shudder at the thought that everyone who's ever told me that they would write a book if only they had time might actually be doing so right now. Do you think that, quarantine will be a prolific time for writers?
Well, I hope so. I had a bit in The Guardian this morning saying, if you write, they wanted advice on how to write during the lockdown. I said, if you write something and invent some characters, you've got some company. If you're really locked down in your house and can't see anyone, if you invent some characters, you've got company. And you don't have to worry about breathing viruses over them. They won't breathe viruses over you. This, I hope they won't.
Are you finding it a particularly inspiring time?
I'm particularly inspiring. It's much like any other time. If you work at home, working at home is much like working at home.
Michael, you were born in 1933, so you're 86 now, and I think you first published back in 62. I'd really like to start talking about your book, My Father's Fortune, though. That was shortlisted for the Costa Book Awards. And it tells us about really where you came from, who you are, if you like. Tell us a little about your father.
My father was a salesman, a rep for a roofing company. We lived in the southern suburbs of London, and I rather took him for granted in his life, and it's only when I wrote the book about him, long after he was dead, and began to think about him in his life, I realised he was, I think, a rather remarkable man. He was set a lot of problems in life. And if you write about someone, you start to see the world through their eyes. And I started to see it through my father's eyes, which I'd never done before, and began to think about the problems he'd been set and how he coped with them. And in the end, I decided, you take your parents for granted, that they're just your parents. But if you write about them, you get to think about them. And I thought in the end, he was a rather good man.
He was deaf. How did that affect your upbringing?
His deafness came on in early middle age. It was a genetic thing. All his family were deaf. And it's very difficult if you're a salesman. He was a technical representative. So the endless questions from architects and builders about the product he was selling. And it must have been fiendishly difficult. Every morning he would wrap himself in a great network of wires and microphones. Hearing aids were a big deal. And they're like a complete sort of broadcasting station rather than just a couple of things that I've got hidden in my ears. And he would go off to work. And one of the ways he coped with his deafness was to keep the conversational initiative by telling jokes, being funny. Because if you tell a joke, people just laugh or they don't laugh. You don't have to hear their response. And I think maybe that inclined me towards this way of dealing with life, of making a joke of it.
Because at school, it certainly seemed that was, from what I've read, that actually being funny about things was what got you through.
Yes. Well, I think I'm always saying this, that I don't think it's me that's funny, it's the world. There are a lot of very funny, a lot of terrible things about the world we don't have to say. But there's also a lot of funny things, and you can't help noticing them.
Of course, you left school at a turbulent time, and the war must have influenced your early life greatly.
Well, the war was long over by the time I left school, and it was a rather good time. In fact, I had all the luck, too young to serve in the war, but old enough to get all the advantages of the social changes that were coming in after the war. Health service, of course, which was important for a family like mine. It was quite difficult to afford private medicine then. and overwhelmingly education. The chance of actually going first to a grammar school and getting a serious academic education, and then going on to university, going to Cambridge. I mean, I look back on that time, and I can't believe how lucky I was.
During national service, you learned Russian.
Yeah, well, it was another stroke of luck. You had to do, men had to do 2 years national service then. Most people spent their time just polishing their boots or painting the coal white or whatever. But for some people, it was worse because we were fighting in Korea, in what was then called Malaysia, and in what was then called Kenya. So a lot of people were going out and getting wounded and killed. And in fact, to get onto the Army Russian course and spend a year being taught Russian by the Slavonic Department at Cambridge University, when I was interested in Russia anyway and wanted to learn Russian, was just wonderful. And it was very nice to, I'd been at a day school, grammar school, to have all the pleasures of being at a boarding school when I was old enough to not to suffer from homesickness and all the other things that affect people in boarding schools. And there were all these clever people like Alan Bennett. Alan and I were on that same course together. And it was just a great pleasure to be with them.
Now, we know that famously you're on the left politically. Were you attracted by communism?
Oh, yes. When I was a schoolboy, my friend and I were a kind of unofficial communist cell. We never actually joined any political organizations, I think because we thought we were too grand and above that kind of thing. But we were as left as could be. And that's one of the things that got me interested in Russia in the first place. I knew everything was in a state of wonderful social perfection in Russia, and I wanted to find out about it. It wore off quite quickly, but the interest in Russian remained.
Mm. And of course, you famously translated Chekhov, which we'll come back to in a little while. Tell me about your newspaper work. Was working on newspapers your first job?
Yes, it was another stroke of luck. When I left Cambridge, getting 6 months tryout on the what was then called the Manchester Guardian in Manchester as a reporter. And I assumed I would spend 6 months writing odd little paragraphs, you know, while they trained me and checked out whether I could actually do the job. And in fact, it wasn't like that. You were just thrown in the deep end, and you did what was called then colour reporting, going around covering odd folkways in the north of England from day one. Great pleasure, absolutely wonderful. And again, wonderful colleagues. Very nice to be working in the Guardian office and very enjoyable work to do.
You were also a television and theatre critic. What was that shift then between critic to practitioner?
I wouldn't like to say I was a television or theatre critic. If you were a reporter on The Guardian, one of the nice things is you expect you to do other things like write leaders and write book reviews and review local theatre. I was terrible at it. I was very savage. When I look back on some of those reviews I wrote now, I cringe.
How did you make the shift between talking about what other people were writing and actually writing plays yourself?
Well, it took me a long time to come around to plays, but I knew I wanted to write novels. I moved on from being a reporter on The Guardian to writing a column, a sort of funny column. And I was doing it 3 times a week, and I knew I wanted to write novels, so I absolutely could not do it while I was writing 3 columns a week. So I moved to The Observer and started writing 1 column a week, and that gave me 3 or 4 days a week to start writing books. But I was certainly didn't start writing the theatre then. I despised the theatre at that time. I thought it was an absolutely appalling institution. And I devoted a lot of those columns to mocking it and saying how embarrassing it was to go to the theatre, just waiting for actors to forget their lines or drop their props. And I'm afraid this was because when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, I wrote the May Week Review, which was the big theatrical event in sort of light theatre in Cambridge every year. And traditionally, we did 2 weeks in Cambridge and then we'd go into the West End for 2 weeks. And my show was the first for many years which didn't go into the West End. It didn't go into the West End because it was terrible. It wasn't very funny. And I'm afraid I reacted badly and turned against the theatre. It took me many years. I was in my late 30s before I gradually reeled back into the theatre.
As you say, you started with novels. Now, of course, of those, Towards the End of the Morning is really the classic, the seminal Fleet Street novel, really, isn't it? Was that you?
Not really. Since I worked for The Guardian and The Observer, everyone assumes that the newspaper portrayed in Towards the End of the Morning is either The Guardian or The Observer. I don't think it's much like either. I think it's fictitious. No one ever believes this about writers of fiction. They do actually make things up. They tell lies. They don't always just put their friends and relations in, just change their name and the colour of their eyes. They do actually invent things. And I think it's certainly not a newspaper like I ever worked on. It's a very old-fashioned newspaper, very fusty sort of place. Not at all like the Guardian then in Fleet Street was just one or two rooms over the post office. But the main office was still in Manchester.
From that on to plays, as you say, Noises Off is probably your most famous play. And as I said at the beginning, it's huge in Harare, the Repertory Society of Zimbabwe. It performs one of your plays at least once a year, I would say. And you're absolutely huge there. Noises Off, though, has travelled incredibly well, hasn't it? I mean, it's really relatable in every country in the world.
It is very surprising. When it was first of all, no one thought it would work at all. And then when it was a success in London, everyone said, it could work in this country because it's partly a pastiche of an English sex farce. Everyone knows what English sex farce is like in England, but it could never work anywhere else because they haven't seen an English sex farce. Well, for some reason, it works in Harare and other places where they probably have actually seen English sex farces in Harare. But somehow it does get beyond those local cultural barriers.
I mean, I guess, is it because it's part of a theme of human motivation and attempts, our own attempts to impose order?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sometimes sort of trying to work out why it is that it does work with audiences elsewhere. And I think, I mean, it's about a show going wrong and the actors making desperate attempts to keep the performance going. And I think there's a bit of that in all our lives all the time. We're all putting on a performance. I'm putting on a performance now, you're putting on a performance. But even if we're not doing an interview, even if we're just talking to that neighbour, talking to our partner, we're still presenting ourselves to the world. And I think sometimes people worry that they might not be able to go on with the performance. I think it's this sort of secret nagging fear inside people. And sometimes it happens. People do have breakdowns and they can't go out and face the world. And I think if you see other people in front of you, actors, you know, everyone thinks actors are ridiculous in some kind of way. They're making fools of themselves in front of you. It kind of releases the fears inside yourself. Well, that's all the grand posh piece of psychological theorising. Or maybe they just like laughing, I don't know.
Your play, Copenhagen, was completely different from Noises Off. Again, did fantastically well on both sides of the Atlantic, won many, many awards. It's such a celebrated script, but it departs from so many writing conventions. It doesn't have a protagonist and antagonist, a traditional dramatic arc. Why do you think it works so well?
I must admit, I don't know what this traditional dramatic format is with a protagonist and an antagonist. I really don't know. It's about something important. It's about the development of nuclear weapons, which could yet overtake pandemics and climate change and actually destroy the world. Actually, my granddaughter was doing a speaking event at school, and she wrote a wonderful speech from which she discovered how many nuclear weapons have been lost during the Cold War. The Americans have lost 5. They've nowhere, I think 4 of them are, one that's completely lost. And it's thought that the Soviet Union have lost 50, and I've given the faintest idea where they are. So it's obviously still a live subject. But there was a fear in the Second World War that the Germans were going to develop nuclear weapons and get there ahead of us. And if they had, the outcome of the war would have been very different. So maybe it's relating to something that's part of our history, where history could have taken a very different turn. I should say it's about a meeting between two physicists during the war. One, Dane Bohr, who was effectively on the Allied side, and Heisenberg, who was German, and it was quite difficult for him to explain to Bohr, was actually running the German atomic weapon program. And maybe also because it's about, I think what the subject really is finally is beyond talking about the particular event. It's about about human motivation. The question in the play is, why did Heisenberg go to Copenhagen? What did he want to say to Bohr? And there'd be many different interpretations, many different possibilities advanced. And it's very difficult to know, when you stop to think about it, why people do what they do. It's very difficult to know even why one does what one does oneself. One does things and sometimes looks back and thinks of reasons, but other people looking at one and one's actions might think of completely different reasons, and their guess might be better than yours.
I mean, and I guess that's again where we come back to Chekhov, because that seeking for motivation is something that I'm seeing in both of your work. And of course, we know that you have translated Chekhov from Russian. How do you think that, I suppose, being mentored from beyond by a writer has informed your work?
Well, I wouldn't like to compare myself to Chekhov, who was one of the greatest writers there ever was, both in the theatre and on the page. I mean, even if he'd never written anything for the theatre, he'd still be one of the world's greatest writers. But if you translate a play, you have to marinate yourself in it. You have to understand how it works. You can't just do it line by line. You have to think what the characters are up to and how the story is developing. And I think I did absorb something of Chekhov in doing that. It may be a good way of learning how to write things, translating them from another language.
Because your work, Wild Honey, I think that was in the 80s, 84, really expands that. I mean, you really needed to be in Chekhov's head in order to write that piece.
Well, that's based on Chekhov's first play that he left without a title. And he wrote it probably when he was 21, might have been younger, certainly not when he was any older than 21, long before he began to write plays in general. And he didn't know about playwriting. And it's a mess. It goes on for about 6 hours and it switches back from one tone of voice to another. But embedded in that mass of stuff are the most wonderful characters and the most wonderful scenes. And I just tried to help him out of it by translating it and reorganizing it. Actually, one of the things I learned from translating Chekhov was how much his plays depend on plot. I mean, they're so wonderfully written. They appear to be completely unplotted. People just happen to do this and happen to say that, and it's all about mood and feeling. But in fact, if you translate them, you discover that every line is advancing the business of the play. And that is a good lesson. And in plays, you can't hang about. And plot is important. I mean, plot now rather suspect for writers. But the point of plot is to try and discover the shape of events that don't seem in life to have a shape, and to find what their structure is and to bring it out. And that's, after all, what writing is about in general. It's trying to see what we don't quite take in life at the time and to make it clear to us.
Let's talk about your latest work. So this is Magic Mobile. Now, it comes off the back of Matchbox Theatre and Pocket Playhouse, both of those very similar in structure. Just describe to us how that structure works.
They're all short pieces, short sketches, and they were just what I happen to have ideas for. And I think in my extreme old age, I've gone back to sort of second childhood, I've gone back to where I started, writing short pieces again. I mean, one should obviously be writing long things. One should be writing trilogies of plays or a series of 12 novels describing social events, social developments in Britain or whatever. But I think there's also something to be said sometimes for short things. I like short things myself, and I, as a consumer, I like keeping things short. And plays, in fact, have got shorter in general. It's quite interesting. When I first began writing plays, the standard format of a play was three acts. And it was so standard that if you read the famous guide to playwriting, to film writing, I cannot remember the name of the man who wrote it, that everyone does this course in film writing. What he is attempting to teach you to do is how to make a film script have a three-act structure. Well, the theatre has long since given up three acts. No one will do three acts in the theatre now. You can't get audiences to go out for two intervals. So all my early plays, which were written in three-act form, I'd now have to sort of slightly reorganise somehow so they could be done in two acts. And the two-act form then became standard. And then people began to think, well, that's a bit long, two acts. People are waiting to go out to have dinner or go home. And a lot of plays now are one act. They're just 90 minutes or 60 minutes or whatever. So I think things are getting shorter in general. I haven't got quite, on the whole, as short as the sketches in my books, but shorter.
I think the sketches in your books are absolutely perfect in terms of quarantine concentration. Let's have a look at some of what this piece has. I mean, it's just very, very funny. It starts with you, I can't think of a nice way to say this, taking the piss, I suppose, of those overpriced writing courses that one gets. It's just a fabulously funny piece. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a bit bold of me to do this because, in fact, a lot of very good writers have emerged from writing courses, a lot of very famous writers. But I'm a bit struck that there's so many people now who offer these courses, and they tend to be very expensive. You're asked to spend a lot of money to discover how to write. And I can't help feeling that you don't really need them. You can. I offer my writing course when people say, how do you write plays or novels? My writing course, which I offer for nothing, is very short. It's three words. Just do it. Because in the end, that's what you're going to have to do, whether you've taken the lessons or not. In the end, you've got to sit down and just do it.
I think my favourite piece in the entire Magic Birnbaal is Waiting for Godot. You also have wonderful pieces mocking our love for top 10 lists.
Yes, why top 10 lists? Why so many top 10 lists? I mean, endless, endless lists of the best, 10 best this or that. So my piece is about the 10 best lists.
Because you also have things like turning the 10 commandments into 10 terms and conditions. And God pops up quite a lot during the pieces, doesn't he?
A wonderful character, God, absolutely wonderful character. Wouldn't be without him.
Yeah. There's a great piece where there's a pharmaceutical brainstorming session coming up with names for drugs, and it just does make you see how ridiculous some of these names are. And it's just fabulously funny. And in the end, they can't continue because they're laughing at it all too.
Well, they're so arbitrary. There's so many drugs, and they all have to have a separate name. I don't actually know how the drug companies do go about naming them. They must have committees or teams of experts in naming. And it must be quite difficult. They must have to avoid names already being used, try to find names which sound attractive to the public and so on. It's quite difficult. I mean, I can tell you how difficult it is naming even a novel or a play. I've sometimes gone to 100 possible candidates for a novel or a play, and that's just one book or one play. And if you're a pharmaceutical company and you've got 970 different sorts of pill out there on the market, it must be terrible.
Now, there are 35 of these sketches, none of them very long, all fabulous. Do you have a fascination with mobile technology?
Yes, I love technology. I love gadgets. Gadgets don't always love me in return, I'm afraid, and they sometimes are quite difficult, like spoiled children who play up. But I particularly love mobile phones. So it's a bit cheeky of me to mock the form in the format of this book. But mobile phones are amazing. In this tiny, very elegant piece of technology that you can carry in your shirt pocket, you've got everything. I mean, all the knowledge in the world, access to all the literature and art your friends, you can see your friends even during lockdown, you can see your children. They are just astonishing. I think people don't give them all the appreciation they deserve, and they don't see what an astonishing human achievement mobile phones are.
Absolutely, and they may well be lifesavers with all the new apps that are coming up to help us through this coronavirus crisis. Michael, this is going to be made into a four-part series on radio. How much input have you had into that?
Well, I did have some input this time. A lot of my books and both the two earlier collections of pieces have been done by Martin Jarvis, and he is terribly good at doing them. And you can get very, very grand actors to come and sit in a recording studio for a day or 2 days. It didn't take up too much of their time. And he's done them so many times that this time I thought I'd take a serious interest in them. So I worked with Martin on the scripts beforehand, cutting them down. You always leave things shorter still if they're going to be, you can listen to them rather than read them on the page, and making sure that they're actable. And then I went into the studio while he was recording them in London. He was doing about half the recordings in London and about half in Los Angeles, where he lives. And I said, I had a lovely time working with all the actors, but also occasionally making a tiny suggestion of my own.
And so it comes out on Radio 4, and the book itself published on the 7th of May. It's Magic Mobile, published by Faber & Faber. It's by Michael Frayn. Michael, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hole and Charlie Filmer Court. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.